Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, they're doing it. They're definitely doing it. Steve Schmidt had the Karl Rove protege who's running the John McCain campaign. The people who were responsible for smearing John McCain in 2000, saying he had an out-of-wedlock African-American child down in South Carolina. They came right out and said, we're going to make this election about people and not about issues, about personalities and not about issues. And that's what they're trying to do. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And yeah, day before yesterday, or perhaps it was yesterday, as I recall, Barack Obama was talking about John McCain's education policies. He said it's the same old stuff. He said you can put lipstick on a pig, but it's still a pig. Immediately Drudge, the whole right-wing machine, throws up a picture of Sarah Palin and a headline that says lipstick on a pig. And now we've got all this feigned outrage on the right. Barack Obama this morning responding.
What their campaign has done this morning is the same game that has made people sick and tired of politics in this country. They seize on an innocent remark, try to take it out of context, throw up an outrageous ad, because they know that it's catnip for the news media. Some of you may have, I'm assuming you guys heard this watching the news. Right? I'm talking about John McCain's economic policies. I say this is more of the same. You can put lipstick on a pig, but it's still a pig. And suddenly they say, oh, you must be talking about the governor of Alaska. See, it would be funny. It would be funny, except, of course, the news media all decided that that was the lead story yesterday.
Yeah, and he's right. And here's the problem, is that they are going to make it about personalities, and it's going to be about who these people are, not what the issues are, because the majority of Americans are not sufficiently well-educated about the issues to even understand the significance of the issues. And you could run on the issues in the 1930s. You can't run on the issues today, frankly. You've got to run on personality to a large extent. And yeah, I am very concerned that the Obama campaign, I think that they should call, like Carl Wilson does here on KPHJ, they should call Sarah Palin the Queen of Pork, and in response to this, they should bring out a pig with Queen of Pork on it and point out that Sarah Palin got more pork than any other governor in virtually the history of America, certainly as the mayor of her cities, had more pork for her city, and, take advantage of it, use it. In any case, speaking of the personalities of the candidates, who they are as opposed to what they stand for, Bruce Wilson is with us. He's with TalkToAction.org. It's the digit 2, talk number 2, action.org. And Bruce has been looking into Sarah Palin's church. There's some things that, frankly, we should be concerned about, I think, here. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Tell me about the dimensions of Sarah Palin's personality and the behavior of her church that concern you.
Yeah, well, to begin with, I really can't say what Sarah Palin does believe, but I can tell you a lot about her churches and the emergent religious tradition they fall in. One way of getting at this, one thing that in particular stands out in my mind, Palin has been repeatedly blessed in public appearances in Alaska, and there are photographs of this by, especially by people associated with the Wasilla Assembly of God, where she attended for about two and a half decades, 25 years, and so that seems to be above and beyond by far her strongest religious association, and she appeared in public events.
I've seen many of the videos of her there. So sure. this is a church that was actually declared heretical by the Assemblies of God. Do I have that right?
Well, the religious tradition that it is now a part of, back in 1949, the Assemblies of God declared this movement, which goes by, some people call it the, well, it started out as something called Latter Rain. That's one of the names for it, and it's gone through three sort of outpourings over since then. But the Assemblies of God declared it heretical in 1949, and they made a similar statement in 2000. So it's important to understand that this is not about the Assemblies of God.
Is this the movement that was laid out in the movie Jesus Camp and the whole Joel's Army thing? Is that what we're talking about here, raising an army of young, literally children warriors for God?
Yes, it very much is. It is.
This, I think, is very concerning. I worked in Uganda back in the 70s and 80s, and there was a group that was very successful at indoctrinating young children that they should be members of an army of God. In fact, as my recollection is, that's what they called it. And these kids are killers, not to suggest that the Assemblies of God kids are, but indoctrinating children in a militaristic worldview is a really scary thing.
Yeah, there's this movement is you could look at it in some sense as being almost hyper-Republican in terms of the tendency exemplified by George W. Bush there. They're more militaristic. They're more opposed to central government and so on. And there's an awful lot to it, and the theology is, it's probably more than we have time for, but let me get at it this way. Before she, around the time she was going to run for the governorship of Alaska, Sarah Palin was blessed by an African minister named Thomas Muthi, who built his reputation on supposedly effecting miraculous social change in a Kenyan suburb of Nairobi by casting out, quote, the spirit of witchcraft, unquote. And this was more than there was a human being associated with this, i.e. a supposed witch who got drummed out of town. And so after which, supposedly, crime rates plummeted almost to zero, so the claim goes, and so on. But if you actually look at crime reports and statistics from this village in Nairobi, as it turns out, nothing really changed. But the people who Muthi built a career on this, and another man named George Otis, an American who made a series of documentary films about supposed miraculous transformations that happened.
Bruce, let me just interrupt you here. There is no shortage of weird folks who come and speak in churches. You know, and for that matter, synagogues and probably mosques.
Sure.
I've certainly been in churches and synagogues when people have said strange things that I didn't agree with, and particularly visiting speakers. This seems at a certain level to be kind of guilt by association. What is the dimension of Sarah Palin's participation in this that should cause us to be concerned? Or is there not anything specific?
Well, I haven't been making a study of her particular record as governor. I'm more looking at the dominant trend in terms of religious beliefs in certainly three out of the four of her Alaska churches. And I'd also add that the head pastor of the Wasilla Assemblies of God, Ed Kalmans, has also, in sermons, said, and he stated that were Jesus Christ to be installed as the literal, and he used that word literal, ruler of our area, then suicide would cease,
this is the end day theology, basically. The rapture stuff or pre-rapture.
No. Well, without even getting into that, the claim was that I took it to mean that Kalmans was saying if we had a theocracy in our area and under our belief system that there would be a miraculous social transformation. That's what I was getting at. It's, if you look at the faith-based initiative under Bush, this is almost, you could look at it as a radical extension of that. In other words, you don't need government programs. You can simply cast out demons. And this is a movement which believes the earth is, geographic areas are controlled by demons and also human beings. So it's suffused with demons. Now, whether Palin believes this or not, All I can say is that she's chosen to attend churches that are very much, that three of the four at least are squarely in this stream. It's harder to pin down the fourth, the latest, but this has been her chosen association.
Yeah.
So why she goes to this church, I mean, it's not a random thing, in other words.
She is not on the record in promoting a theocracy, though, in any way.
I think people would have noted that, but she has stated that, you probably heard this, that the U.S. Occupation of Iraq is God's mission, and she's made certain statements that indicate that she thinks they're...
Well, I guess time is going to tell, you know, whether she's as extremist as many of the people who attend the churches that she attends are, or whether she just happens to, for whatever purpose, for, you know, because it's politically expedient, it's a big church, there's a lot of voters there, or because she likes the services she's been hanging out in these places. Bruce Wilson, talk digit2action.org. Thanks, Bruce.
Okay.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And buenos dias, my friends. Tom Hartman here.
Alive. You heard we were trying to make the telephone lines work here in the last segment with all this magic technology, and ultimately we just said, screw the technology, we'll use a telephone. So I am here in Lima, Peru, and the day before yesterday, I was out at the Corral Archaeological Project, and we have Gonzalo Rodriguez Carpio. He's going to be speaking with us in just a moment, an archaeologist in that site, about this is a fascinating thing. But first, I'll just give you an overview of our program today. Mark Weisbrot is going to be with us at the top of the next hour. He's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research about what's going on in the country next door here in Bolivia. And Venezuela's also gotten into the act. Honduras has gotten into the act. And it looks like even Russia is getting into the act. What's going on? Last night I was watching TV. I was watching Hugo Chavez, and with my bad Spanish, I could still tell that he was yelling that the CIA was causing all these problems. So we'll find out what Mr. Weisbrot has to say about that at the top of the next hour. And then on our third hour, Chalmers Johnson is going to be here. He's the author of Nemesis, The Last Days of the American Empire, and this is the final volume in his Blowback trilogy. We'll also be taking your calls at 866-303-2270. And so that's our day, and that's our schedule for the day. And right now I want to introduce Gonzalo Rodriguez Carpio. He is an archaeologist, a graduate student at Binghamton University in New York, Peruvian, and with the Corral Archaeological Project. And Gonzalo, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you very much, Tom. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you. And tell me, Gonzalo, the Corral, this archaeological site that you're working at, this is a mother city, and apparently the only one in the world that is intact. What is a mother city?
Well, it's something that is like the source, the origin for this long development in the Andes. You know, we are talking about the origin of civilization in a part of the world that is isolated, is different than the old world, and it takes 4,000 years. And all of this starts in Corral. That's what we are talking about.
So this is a city. A mother city is the first city that people built when they stopped being hunter-gatherers for 100,000 years and began living in cities. And my understanding is that the significance of this, of Corral, is twofold. First of all, it's the oldest city known in North or South America, in the Western Hemisphere. And secondly, that because it was so perfectly preserved, because there was apparently, after about 1,000 years, a climate change that just covered it with sand, that it's Dr. Ruth Shady, who is your boss and who I spent the day with, part of the day with, you have excavated some much of the site, and all the remains seem to indicate that for the 1,000 years that this oldest city in the world, the first virgin city, the first mother city that has ever been discovered, that wasn't totally contaminated by having other cities built on top of it, that for 1,000 years, the people of the city, there is absolutely no evidence of warfare. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. You know, the city is not surrounded by walls. We don't have evidence of weapons or any other kind of warfare. So it's really surprising for us, and it's really amazing. The clue to understand this civilization is, in some way, is trade and a deep understanding of the environment and an equilibrium between the resources of the coast and of the valley. The key to understand that is the exchange of products from the valley and the coast, especially cotton, per anchovies. Of course, another components that are important are religion. We don't know exactly what were the components, but we know that this implied this kind of harmony with the environment, and that's the clue for us to understand it. In some sense, those are the values that Caral can give to the world and were inherited for other later Andean cultures.
Yeah, this sounds almost New Agey, but it's in light of the modern destruction of our environment, the hunting-gathering people had apparently figured out how to live in balance with their environment without destroying it. So when they built a city, they built it in such a way that they were in the plain. This is 14 miles from the seacoast, and they were growing cotton, and they were using the cotton to make fishing nets, which they were trading with the people at the seacoast who were gathering anchovies, and this was the trade that they had between the two. And that they had figured out a way to live in absolute balance with their environment and with the people in the other city. And so for 1,000 years, there was no war. Also, there's some evidence that this is a society where men and women had equal power. We have about a half a minute here.
We don't have too much evidence because we don't have too much human remains, but one surprising of these discoveries that we have is an often, when we have in a cache, we found the representation of men of women from equal size. The man is facing women, and we have this evidence for that.
And this, Dr. Shady told me this indicates that women played a high role in society. We have to take a break here. It's 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, live from Lima, Peru.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
I climbed across the mountain top.
And welcome back, my friend. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour, live from Lima, Peru. And we'll be in San Francisco, by the way, the rest of the week. Carl Wilson will be filling in for me tomorrow as I'm traveling home. And we're here. We've been talking about Corral, and we will get back to that in just a moment. But first, I just wanted to comment on what's going on also with the banking industry. With the Lehman Brothers melting down this morning, the purchase of Bear Stearns by the Bank of America. There's what we're seeing right now, and this is cannot be understated. This is, I think, so very, very important that people understand this. That when Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae were privatized or were taken over by the federal government, then what this what this means, what it meant fundamentally was the failure of privatization. These were two government agencies, Freddie and Fannie. They were created in order to provide liquidity and to provide easy money, cash, to banks so the banks could loan those monies to people so people could buy houses. And they should have always been government institutions. Nobody should be hustling that. Nobody should be making a profit off the back of what should be a government institution that is designed to keep the banks solvent. Similarly, but they did, you know, because we had this privatization wave in the 1980s and Reagan and everything else. And so Freddie and, well, actually, this happened in 68. This was LBJ doing it to try and get the Vietnam War off the books. But, you know, they've been very happy ever since. And then in 1999, Phil Graham and his wife Wendy, who's a big-time lobbyist, passed a law that changed. It was the Graham something law. Here I am in Peru. I don't have all my notes in front of me. That did away with the Glass-Steagall Act. The Glass-Steagall Act was passed in 1938 by the Roosevelt administration, and it said it's illegal for banks to gamble. Basically, it's illegal for banks to be in the investment business. And it's illegal for investment companies, gambling houses, basically, companies that are betting on the stock market and that have a lot of people investing money with them based on bets, on margin calls. It's illegal for them to be in the banking business because you don't want the banking business to be contaminated by people gambling on how much, you know, on the stock market, and you don't want the stock market business to be in the bank business. Well, Phil Graham and his buddies in the big banks, they wanted the big banks said, hey, there's a lot of money being made in gambling here. We want to get back into that. And so that is the direct result of this. So what we're seeing is the end of the regulation. You know, when Rush Limbaugh said Roosevelt is dead, his programs live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well. This is what they were doing. And so we are, you know, this morning one of the headlines was that Obama is pointing out that we are seeing in these bank failures and the economic crashes all around the world, by the way, the direct failure of the systems that McCain and the Republicans, and frankly, this goes back to Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, have been advocating for 30 years. And this is the absolute predictable result of that. And so that is the problem that we're looking at. So a couple of other points that I wanted to make very quickly. Sarah Palin apparently is still saying that she said no on the bridge to nowhere. Why? Because if she admits that she was a liar, that's political death. She has to do that. She absolutely has to do that. Jim Sinclair has an interesting commentary, by the way, over at jsmineset.com. He talks about how J.P. Morgan back in 1907, pretty much the exact same thing was happening. People were running margin calls. They were buying things on credit. They were buying stock on credit without any money. Naked, what are called naked shorts, and or naked seller, whatever it may be, and buying these things on credit without the money to back it up. And J.P. Morgan, you know, pulled these guys into his office, and particularly Jesse Livermore, and said, you guys can't do it. And back in those days, these groups that did this were called trusts. And Teddy Roosevelt was famous as the trust buster. He broke them up. They have been reinvented. They have reincarnated. And they've reincarnated as hedge funds. So what we're seeing right now is the exact same thing. It's the hedge funds. It's coming all back all over again here. And so here we have Lehman Brothers, 158-year-old investment bank, crashing and burning. Why? Because Phil Graham, the chief economic advisor to John McCain, had his way in 1999, and Bill Clinton went along with it. The Democrats went along with it. I thought, oh, yeah, it's worked fine since the New Deal, but, you know, we can pass on that for the moment, which is just absolutely nuts. So we'll get back to that, and we'll get back to your calls in just a moment. But while I have Gonzalo Rodriguez Caprio here with me, the archaeologist from Corral, I just wanted to get back very quickly with him in this conversation, as he was kind enough to come to Lima to be on the program with us today. And Gonzalo, the site at Corral was discovered when and how?
Well, the site was discovered in the early 1940s, almost by chance, by an American archaeologist by the name of Paul Kosok. But although it came in that time, never realized the importance of the site until the beginning of the 1990s, when Dr. Rosciadi started the research project that. And it's so important for Peru that in 2001, the Peruvian government declared it of national interest. And now the project is right, it's running completely with funds from the Peruvian government. We are proud of this site, and all along in the recent years, several other sites from the same time and probably related with this early civilization have been discovered. Many generations of Peruvian archaeologists have been training in this to understand these early civilizations.
One of the big debates between conservatives and liberals in the United States, between these competing political perspectives, the core of the debate is whether people are at their nature good or evil. And the conservatives argue that people are essentially evil in their nature, in their core nature. And therefore, people, if they build cities, will always build fortresses, and they will always be places of warfare. And in fact, that's the reason why their cities were built. And this has been conventional wisdom for, you know, 1,000 years of civilization, probably longer, and for at least 300 years since these debates during the Enlightenment. And the significance, correct me if I'm wrong, but the significance of the discovery of Corral, of a city that lasted 1,000 years, the oldest city in the Western Hemisphere, one of the oldest cities in the world, that came into being at about the same time similar mother cities were emerging in Asia, in China, in the Middle East, in northwestern Africa, that in Egypt, that it was that because this site is uncontaminated, we can see that in fact the people lived in peace, and this argues that it is possible. I mean, this I think this gives us tremendous hope that it is possible that people can live in peace if they learn to live in balance with each other. Apparently there was gender equality here. If they learn to live in balance with their environment, and if they learn to live in balance, and in this case it was a trade balance, between other communities. Am I summarizing all this well, and can you comment a little on this? Because this is I think, at the core of our big political arguments around the world right now.
Yes, that's true, Tom. You know, this debate about what is the origin of civilization and the development of cities and the relation with the increase of population and also with warfare has been in academic circles for several years. Now it's the first time that we can contribute to this big debate. That what we are open is the chance of probably a different kind of civilization with this right balance between human beings and between environment. Of course, we need to continue with the research. We have more questions than answers, as usual. But we know, 5,000 years ago, if you go around in the world, you will see three places where civilization is growing: Egypt, Mesopotamia, and now in the central coast in Peru, near where we are now. These two civilizations in the old world were in contact with each other, and we have inherited most of them. From the Andes, although there are many things that we have given to the world, including several crops like potatoes, or cotton, corn, but also this peaceful way of living, at least for a millennium. Thank you very much.
Yeah. At least for a millennium, for 1,000 years. It was literally 1,000 years of peace, like they talk about in the Bible. This is Gonzalo Rodriguez Carpio, an archaeologist and one of the lead archaeologists in the Corral Archaeology Project and a graduate student at Binghamton University. Our number 866-303-2270 if you want to give us a shout, and we can pick up any of the topics that you'd like. Gonzalo, just very quickly before we wrap this up, we have a minute or two. I know a few years ago, people going out to this site were at some risk. In fact, the Shining Path was blowing up towers all along the way. When I went out day before yesterday, we had a bodyguard who had a pistol with him, although because we took all these back roads to get there, there's some dangerous roads and some dangerous people. But it seems that the situation is getting better now. Yes?
Yes, that's right. In fact, now you can visit Caral. We have you have many places where people can stay. We are working in the reception area. We are receiving tourists. We are proud of that too. In 2003, only 3,000 people visit Caral. Now almost 5,000 people can stay there. And we work close with the local population, trying to helping them to work with us as workers, also as local guides. But also there is a master plan for the development of the valley that is trying to keep these two ideas to preserve the cultural heritage and at the same time the environment.
Thank you. That's very good. We're going to take a break now. We'll come back with your calls on this or any of the topics of the day at 866-303-2270. Tom Hartman here live from Lima, Peru. We're broadcasting from Union La Radio, 880 AM in Lima, Peru. We'll be right back. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Monday, the 15th of September. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from Lima, Peru. And our number 866-303-2270, toll-free all across the United States. What's going on with the banks? I think it's fairly obvious. By the way, I just want to add, and thank you so much to our guest, the archaeologist who has now left. You know, we can take calls on the topic as well. I am concerned with regard to this whole economic thing, the whole meltdown of the banks, by the fact that while the stock market is crashing and people are bailing out of the banking investments, that we're not seeing, in fact, we're seeing the opposite. We're not seeing the price of oil and gold and other commodities go up. And what this implies to me, and I may well be wrong on this, but this is my guess. What this implies to me is that the increase, the spike that we saw in the price of gold and oil was essentially a bubble. It was manipulated. It may well have been not just a few speculators in Wall Street, but also the country of Russia that has enormous gold reserves that was doing this and then, you know, sell a whole bunch while the price is at the peak. But the biggest thing that this points out is that what we're looking at is actually a liquidity crisis, a lack of cash crisis, or a lack of access to cash, of credit. Because if investors had actual money, they would be moving that money into assets, and you'd be seeing those asset prices going up. And because they're not, it means that the money has simply vanished. The last time we saw that kind of a scenario in the United States was in 1930. And so my sense of this, and again, I'm not putting myself out as an economist, although I've written a couple of books on economics, and I guess you can call me an amateur student of it, but my sense of this is that Greenspan was right yesterday when he said this is a once-in-a-century event, that it's actually twice in the last 100 years. The last time was 70 years ago, or 80 years ago, and that it is a true liquidity crisis, that we're seeing actually money vanishing. And then to compound it, in the 1930s, we actually made things in the United States. We generated value. We're no longer generating value. So we don't have money to buy things with, so instead we're simply trading houses with each other. And we're borrowing against our houses to buy stuff from China, which is generating value because they are manufacturing things. We're not manufacturing things anymore. We're not making value. So once again, we see that the flat world trade policies of Thomas Friedman, the borrow and spend Reaganomics policies of the Reagan administration and Phil Graham and John McCain have not just set us up for another Republican Great Depression, but one that may be far worse, frankly, than the one in the 1930s, because at least in the 1930s we still manufactured things. The core, the manufacturing sector, manufacturing core of America's economy was still very, very strong. 866-303-2270, your telephone number. Ann in Walnut Creek, California. Hey, Ann, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you? Well, what a surprise to find out where you are. Well, I was calling about the archaeological project, and it makes me nervous because I'm remembering, and forgive me, I know very little about archaeology, but was it the Incas or the Aztecs that it was finally very late discovered, or maybe finally spoken of, that they had existed by doing human sacrifice and cannibalism?
Yeah, these were both much later civilizations. Corral
okay.
was from 4,700 years ago. The Aztecs and the Incas were less than 1,000 years ago. Those two civilizations emerged about the same time that the major kingdom civilizations were emerging in Europe.
Well, the archaeologist that you briefly interviewed sounded very hesitant about the religious aspect. And, you know, I just got nervous. And also I got nervous when I heard that they were trading with the fishermen for anchovies, and I'm wondering whether anchovies would be enough for their protein, for their, that kind of protein needs. And, you know, it just seems to me that they better make darn sure that there wasn't human sacrifice and cannibalism before they, you know, put too much emphasis on this, and before
yeah.
we use it as a wonderful demonstration that
sure.
one can live in peace.
No, I get your point, Ann. But the fact of the matter is that there was no army. There were no fortifications around the city. There was no evidence of weapons, the kinds of weapons that would be used in warfare.
Right.
The you know, anchovies and whatnot, certainly they were traded. They were growing a lot of crops in Corral, and they were
right.
trading the crops and the cotton with the folks on the seashore. But it's an interesting point. With regard to the religion, he was vague because they just don't know. They just don't know. They found a number of figurines, and in the figurines, the men and women seemed to be of equal status, or the women actually seemed to be of higher status than the men. That's something that is fascinating. Kevin in Texas, we have just a half a minute here, Kevin, before we've got to wrap up this hour.
Mr. Hartman, I just wanted to call you and let you know I love your show, love the topics that you discuss, the issue that you're talking about, the civilizations of indigenous people throughout the world, and that the historical understanding that I'm perceiving, I'm starting to lean to, is that up until the Europeans conquered the indigenous world, warfare wasn't a part of their survival, their existence, or their participation with their...
You may well be right, Kevin. You may well be right. And there are a lot of people who agree with that perspective, and it's a fascinating one. 57 minutes past the hour. We'll be back at the top of the hour. We'll talk about what's going on here in South America.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from Union La Radio, in Lima, Peru. And we've got our technology working. Hopefully my voice sounds a little better now than it did a few minutes ago. And... Let's talk for a few minutes about what's going on down here in South America. This is a very problematic situation. Mark Weisbrot is with us. He is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, the author of numerous papers and articles on Bolivia and Latin America, including a new report, The Distribution of Bolivia's Most Important Natural Resources and the Autonomy Conflicts. He wrote an op-ed, Bolivia, Can the Majority of People Vote for Change and Actually Get It? I recently traveled to Bolivia, where he met with both high-level government officials and opposition politicians in the lowlands. And Mark Weisbrot, are you with us?
One second.
I'm sorry. He's, in fact, looks like we just dropped the line. While we're waiting for him to come on, let's just pick up a couple phone calls here and say hi. Sean in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hey, Sean, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, welcome back.
Thank you.
You were traveling way down south.
Yeah, well, I'm here now. I'm in Lima, Peru, this very minute.
Oh, you still are? Really? Terrific.
Yes. Yeah.
I hope you're going to see Machu Picchu.
I won't have the time. I've heard that it's beautiful, but I'm flying home tomorrow.
Listen, what I wanted to point out, Tom, is that in the previous election, last election, the Republicans began to do this deal with the polls, saying they were very, very close. The reality wasn't that. So they keep on hammering this, the same thing this time. So when elections, the results are all there, they can actually crank up their results and say, well, we won for a margin or by a margin or whatever. And everybody really believes that because they've been hammering this stuff, although they're way behind on the polls. I mean, all this, the right has all controls all the polls and the radios and everything else. So people are being hammered this every single day. So people have to be talking. People out there, you and so forth, have to remind folks that's not the reality of the case. The polls are manipulated, you know?
Yeah. And Sean, I have some real concerns about these polls. The fact that people under 30, basically people without using cell phones are by and large not being polled. That actually there's a whole series of problems with the polls. I think that the polling companies, because Democrats are being registered in massive numbers right now and Republicans are not, holding on to the registered voters, yet the polling companies seem to be looking for 50-50 parity. I think the polls are all wrong. And I think you're right that it makes it a lot easier to steal an election if you get lousy polls, but time will tell. Mark Weisbrot is finally with us. Mark?
Yes, hi.
Hey, welcome to the show.
Thanks, great to be back.
Last night, I'm here in Lima, Peru right at the moment, and last night I was flipping through the channels on the local TV and got to Channel 4, the local news channel, and they ran a good 5-minute clip of Hugo Chavez talking about Bolivia. And he was just quite, my Spanish is, muy feo, muy malo, not so good, but I could figure out what, and I studied Spanish for 2 years back when I was much younger. I got it that he was blaming the CIA for what's going on in Bolivia. What's going on in Bolivia, Mark?
Well, you have the right wing there really rejecting the results of the referendum on August 10th, where the president was reaffirmed by enormous 67% of the vote, and they're pursuing their kind of destabilization, opposition by other means, including violence, and including in Pando what appears to be a massacre. And the death toll keeps rising, but the latest count is around 30.
Wow. I was in Venezuela briefly some years back when the kind of 2 or 3 day coup, I forget how long it was fairly short, where they deposed Chavez and came back. And it was frankly just a coincidence. Louise and I were there in one of the border city or coastal cities. And after that happened, after the dust settled, it came out that the U.S. actually was involved in trying to depose him, had been supporting in some ways, and perhaps you can give us more detail on that.
No, there's no doubt about it. The media does not report that, though. They had one article in the New York Times and a couple other papers in the last 6 years since the coup that actually described the U.S. role. And now they usually say the U.S., the standard line that you see in the New York Times and everywhere else is that the United States gave tacit support to the coup, when in fact, according to our own State Department documents, they did a lot more than that. They funded people who were involved in the coup. And then when it happened, both the White House and the State Department made public statements trying to make it look like it wasn't a coup at all. And, of course, then the IMF, which is run by the U.S. Treasury Department still, made a public statement within 4 hours of the coup saying that they stood ready to give money to the new government. So they did a whole lot of things, and of course then there's all the things we don't know about. In terms of Bolivia, again, the media is treating this as though these are completely unfounded accusations, but in fact we do know that AID is funding, U.S. Agency for International Development, which is part of the State Department, is funding opposition groups there. We do know.
Well, I'll tell you, the commentators here on Peruvian television, the newscasters, were treating this like it was a solid story, not like it was, you know, a wild-eyed, crazy accusation.
Oh, that's good. That's quite different from what you have here. It's given absolutely no legitimacy as a claim in the international press. And I've been talking to reporters about it, and one thing I said to them, you know, just call the U.S., just call AID and ask them. They won't deny that they're funding opposition groups. I mean, what they would say is that we fund people across the political spectrum.
But, you know, there's a larger issue here, Mark, and that is that it doesn't even... We don't even need to involve ourselves because what happened with Chavez, and I think Evo Morales, the president of Bolivia, is frankly a much purer example, a better example of this. Here's a guy who has indigenous roots, local Indian roots. He was actually a coca farmer at one point in his life. And what he has tried to do is basically land reform. He's saying that on and you'll have to tell me which part of the country, the east or the west, but in one part of the country, there's an enormous amount of mineral wealth and oil wealth and land oligarchies, basically. These oligarchs, these very, very wealthy families. And he's going in and he's saying, you know, either by fiat, by the equivalent of what's our Fifth Amendment taking, eminent domain, or by taxation, we're going to essentially take some of this land and some of this wealth and share it with the people on the other side of the country who are, in some cases, starving. And so the wealthy folks are rising up and saying, no way, Charlie, you're not taking my stuff, you're not taking my land, you're not taking my money, and we will shoot it out in the streets. Is that a reasonable description of what's going on?
Well, I think it's a big part of the story. I mean, you know, just to qualify some of it, there hasn't been any seizure of land yet, and it's, I don't think the government would take any land without compensation, just compensation,
right.
For example.
Just like we don't. I mean,
but
so far he's just calling for constitutional change to allow this, isn't he?
That's right, and the gas revenue, it's hydrocarbon revenue, which is mostly overwhelmingly natural gas that goes to Brazil, primarily Brazil and Argentina. And the what Evo did, what his government did, well, it actually began even before him in 2005, is the government has gradually gotten control over the gas revenues and therefore has increased its take enormously. So the provinces, including these four, they're called the Media Luna, the Half Moon, provinces, because they form kind of a crescent along the eastern side of the country. This is Pando, where the massacre took place in the last couple of days. Beni, Santa Cruz, and Tarija. Santa Cruz is the largest state and has the biggest, richest landowners, and is the most stubborn and militant against the government. These provinces are getting more money. Now, so much money from the gas revenues because of the government's renationalization that
right.
they can't
Mark,
even
can
spend
you, it. Can you hold that thought and we can pick it up on the other side of the break?
Okay.
Okay, stick around. We're talking with Mark Weisbrot, and we'll be right back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from Lima, Peru. We're talking about the country right next door. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Heartaches by the number 601. one half dozen of the other.
21 minutes past the hour, Mike. Mark Weisbrot is with us, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, the author of numerous papers and articles on Bolivia and Latin America, including a new report, The Distribution of Bolivia's Most Important Natural Resources in the Autonomy Conflicts. Just speaking here a few minutes ago with during the break with Patricia Viejas, who is, has facilitated my travel here and helped us hire the bodyguard and a car and everything for our trip out to Corral on Friday. And she was talking about how they're having a medical strike. The doctors and nurses are on strike apparently right now in Peru, that the government is not collecting revenues from the mines and that and from the casinos. And Mark, is this the essentially kind of crony capitalism kind of thing? Is this pretty endemic across South America? And is this the pushback that Evo Morales is facing? Is that what he's up against, that sort of thing?
Well, yeah, he's up against a whole bunch of things, but it is basically an elite that has, you know, run the country. And in Bolivia's case, it's similar to South Africa in some ways, in the sense that it was an apartheid society. And so Evo was the first indigenous president elected, and it really, and the government is, has a lot of indigenous people in it. And so they're not, as marginalized and excluded as they always were in the past. So it's a huge, huge, change in that sense as well. But on the economic issues, I think it's more similar, to the rest of Latin America. Well, you have these left, you know, governments now in Venezuela, Ecuador, Bolivia, left-of-center governments in Argentina, Brazil, Uruguay, Paraguay. And so, you know, there's been a lot of change, and all of these governments have certain things in common in the sense that they're trying to deliver on at least some of their provinces, their promises to change people's lives. Now, in Bolivia, the government has delivered, immediately by getting control over the gas revenue and beginning to use it for some of the things they promised, schools, hospitals, education, health care, and most recently in part of this conflict is a very small pension, $26 a month for people over 60. And the eastern lowland states, the right-wing opposition, those governors and the violent mobs that they support, they're resisting this. They're saying you can't take this gas revenue and use it for this little pension. That's the biggest fight they're having right now.
So that's the essence of the fight right now. People, they're stirring up these mobs. They're going into the streets because Evo Morales wants to take taxes, he's taxing the gas revenue, and he wants to take that money and give a $26 a month pension to people over 62 years old. Is
the
Social Security funded by gas?
That's right. If you ask the leader, the most important leader of the opposition, the governor of Santa Cruz, he was publicly said that the other day. Well, the government's not serious about negotiating. If we want to sit down and negotiate, he's got to reverse that change in the, it's called the indirect tax on hydrocarbons that's being used for this pension instead of coming directly to the provinces. And this is, you know, again, it's hard to sympathize with this because they're getting hundreds of millions of dollars. They've got billions. These provinces have billions right now sitting on reserve in the central bank because they can't spend it. It's too much money
for them
to spend.
Right, the wealthy provinces. And the rioting is going on, the fights are going on in Bolivia in the wealthy provinces?
Yes, it's the four the four Media Luna provinces that are, you know, trying to resist the government and just kind of refuse to accept the legitimacy of the government. Now, Pando is a good example where the massacres were, and that's close to, you know, closest to where you are in Peru.
Right.
That's, you know, a province of only about 70,000 people, very remote, hard to get to, and it's only 16% indigenous, whereas the five provinces outside the Media Luna group, the rest of the country, you know, is, you know, probably around, I don't know, 70%, 80% indigenous. So it's a wider...
Mark, we have you know, about a half a minute here. Friday, we tried to contact, we contacted, in fact, the embassy of Bolivia, and they said that none of their ambassadors around the world are allowed to talk on this at all. How is this story going to get out?
Well, it's going to get out the way all the, I mean, you know, it gets out.
The corporate media is not handling it the way that you and I are talking about it right now, you know.
No, they're giving kind of the, you know, more of the U.S. Side of the story. I think, it gets out through the blogs, the alternative media, people like you.
Yeah, well, we all have to keep our eyes on what's going on here because this is the kind of pushback. I mean, this reminds me of, you know, the U.S. bringing the Shah to power. It's the kind of thing where, you know, down the road you end up with these god-awful consequences as a result of it. So, Mark, thanks so much for being with us.
Sure, thank you.
Mark Weisbrot, CEPR.net is the website. Thanks, Mark.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Yes, indeed, time for a change, my friends. It's, let's see, here in Lima, Peru, it's 34 minutes past the noon hour. I think in New York it's 34 minutes after 1, and wherever you may be, or if it's time delayed, whatever, 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here broadcasting live from Lima, Peru, with many thanks to the good people at Union La Radio, AM 880, shortwave 6.155, and FM 103.3. Who are letting us use their studios and simulcasting part of this show. And our telephone number, 866-303-2270. And whether you want to talk about Caral, the ancient city, and or what's going on in South America, I think that this is a harbinger of things to come, frankly. And this is what we're seeing in the United States as well. We're just seeing it in a different way. Instead of people out on the streets rioting, and because the government's trying to do something for poor people, basically, what you're seeing in the United States is basically the rape and robbery of the middle class by the big bankers. They got Phil Gramm in 1999 to pass the law saying that they could do anything they damn well pleased. They did. And now, you know, they're running away with the cash, hundreds of billions of dollars, trillions of dollars, and the average American is left with no savings. In fact, we had negative savings last year. Real purchasing power is down. 866-303-2270, your telephone number. Stuart in West Seattle. Hey, Stuart, what's on your mind today?
Yes, in your discussion of the anti-government violence in next-door Bolivia, you left out a very important question. The question is, to what extent were the rogue elements of our government, like the CIA, backing these anti-government violent people?
Well, no, that's where I started with the conversation. I said last night on TV here in Lima, on Lima TV and from the local Channel 4, I watched for about a 5 or 6 minute segment, which is a long segment, this long rant by Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela, saying over and over and over again that the destabilization in Bolivia was being fomented, was being caused by the U.S. CIA. And the commentators here, they weren't saying, yes, he's right. They also, though, as far as I could tell with my very bad Spanish, were not saying, no, he's wrong. And they gave him a lot of airtime. There's a lot of people, frankly, very concerned about U.S. involvement in this. Although, as I said, you know, to Mark Weisbrot, even if we didn't involve ourselves, you're going to have these oligarchs. You're going to have very, very wealthy and powerful families who have historically, and in a very corrupt fashion, ruled the country. As he pointed out, Bolivia was an apartheid regime. The Spanish ancestry people, I mean, literally from Spain ancestry people, ruled the country, and the indigenous people, the local people, had no power. And they had separate schools, separate everything. And now Evo Morales, who is an indigenous person, is is changing that. You know, the government is changing. It's going through these transformations. So in some ways, it's sort of like, you know, the South in the 1930s, I guess, or something. But I agree. I think that the CIA or USAID, we need to know what our government is doing, frankly, and whether it's representing the best interests of Americans. And it's not even a matter, I mean, of course, it's always a matter of right and wrong, but it's not even a matter just of that. It's a matter of the law of unintended consequences. Are we getting ourselves mixed up in something that is going to be ultimately destructive to us, to the United States? Jack in Coral Springs, Florida. Hey, Jack, what's on your mind?
Yes, I have an interesting piece for you. You can look it up in Google News about going CIA in Bolivia.
Yeah.
Well, the heading of this is from Pristina La Paz, expel U.S. ambassador to Bolivia has been in charge of Kosovo secession. Now, this guy has been raising...
Wait a minute. The U.S. ambassador to Bolivia is
in
charge of...
has been in charge of the Kosovo secession.
The Kosovo secession. And the Kosovo is one of the rich regions that wants to secede from Bolivia so they don't have to give any of the gas wealth? Is that...
Well, this guy was involved in this cleansing on these different countries in Yugoslavia. Between 1994 and
1996. Oh, Kosovo!
Kosovo.
Ah, Kosovo. I'm sorry, I misunderstood. I thought that was the name of one of the states down here that I didn't recognize.
No.
So the U.S. ambassador to Bolivia formerly was involved with the ethnic cleansing in Kosovo.
Okay, now look at this. From 1994 to 1996, he was the State Department Bosnia desk officer at the point when the conflict between Albanian separatists and Serbian and Yugoslavia security forces erupted. During the same period, he served as a special assistant to Ambassador Richard Holbrooke, who was the author of the disintegration of Yugoslavia and the fall of Milosevic. In the later capacity, state embassy, he was a member of the American negotiation team in the lead up to the Dayton Peace Conference and chief of staff for the American delegation at Dayton.
Now that actually may be a recommendation. I mean, I have Holbrooke. I don't think has always been right, but I generally have a lot of respect for him.
I'm sorry, Tom. This guy is the guilty character. Everybody knows in Bolivia that this guy is the reason why this has been going on. He's heading all this situation over there, and here says the heading is expelled. U.S. ambassador to Bolivia has been in charge of Kosovo secession. Now, they know that this guy is involved, and the CIA, these people actually, you know, bankrolling this deal. And in addition to that, you know, they've been doing it all over the place. They did it in Chile, you know, they did it in Argentina, you know, now in Bolivia.
Yeah. Nicaragua.
Exactly.
I mean, back 100 years, we did it in Hawaii.
Exactly. But the problem is, Tom, that people don't understand is that you can do so much of that, and it eventually will be a payback. And, of course, then they say, well, what happened? I mean, we are the innocent victims of this attack or whatever it is, but we've been killing these people, been involved in this stuff for where thousands and thousands of people were killed, like in Argentina, you know, in Chile, 10,000, I mean, and so forth. And go on and on and on and on and on. This has all been done, and nobody in U.S. Best interest. This were like in Chile, for instance, was ITT the one that went to the Congress and crying over there because, again, they wanted to nationalize, you know, a large American company that were taking everything out of the country.
ITT was, you know, in their up to their eyeballs in that. And then you can very easily Google that and track down the stories from
You know, there's a book written by a guy that I'm not crazy about it, about Woodward, called Dale, The Secret Wars of the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, from 1981 to 1987, I have to tell you, spells out everything it was going on at the time. I mean, this is just, it's so much written about it, and people think or talk about alleged involvement. I mean, this is all over the place. It's just a historical record. The only place that doesn't know anything about this is the U.S. Everywhere else, and you go to Germany, and they know all about it. You go to France, they know everything about it. And you want to do some research, you go to the BBC.
Yeah, Jack, you're absolutely right, and as I said, not of course it's the wrong thing to do, But even perhaps more important, ultimately, over the long term, the consequences to the United States, in almost every case that we can track back U.S. involvement in the internal affairs of other countries that were trying to become more democratic or trying to become more egalitarian, and we stepped in on behalf of the most powerful and wealthy families or corporations or oligarchs,
exactly.
It ended up blowing back on us. It ended up leading to the death of many people and blowing back on us.
It's strictly money. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's the bottom line. Jack, I got to move along. I got a million calls here, but thanks so much for the call. You know, very well said. Bob in Clifton, Tennessee, you wanted to talk about Corral?
Yes, I did. Coincidentally, Tom, I happened to be reading The Incas by Nigel Davis, the London Folio Society.
Yeah.
It's an archaeology book, and as I look on the maps here, I cannot find a reference on the 1532 Inca Empire map of this site. And I was
right. That's because the Incas, as I said, the Incas came to power. The Inca and Mayan civilizations are relatively recent. They came to power and became massive. I mean, they're actually larger than the kingdoms of Europe. But it was at the same time that the kingdoms of Europe were in power, from the 1200s or the 1100s through this 1500 or 1600s A.D. Corral is from 3000 B.C.
I understand.
It's 5,000 years old.
So
it vanished under sand after 1,000 years because of a local microclimate change. And so Corral existed from, the best guess is, around 4,700 years ago until around 3,700 years ago, and then it literally vanished, and nobody even knew that it was there up until about 50 years ago.
So, of course,
the Incas didn't even know about it.
I understand, and I look at the maps for the pre-Inca kingdom, and it's also not here, but what I was wondering was, where is it located? That's what I would like to know.
It's about 150 miles, about 200 kilometers north of Lima, about 14 miles in from the sea. If you just go to Google and type in Caral, 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 and Peru, you'll find the whole thing. In fact, there's some great video there and everything else.
So it's close to Chan Chan.
I don't know any of the other places around here. I'm sorry, this is only the second time I've been to Peru, and the first time was 30 years ago. And I've not done the tourist thing, so I came here to see.
And how far from the Pacific Ocean is it?
14 miles.
14 miles. Okay, so that's in what is now the desert area.
Yeah, it is. It is desert area, and in fact, it's amazing to look at it because these hills that look like they're just giant sand dunes, when they dug out the sand, what they found were pyramids and houses and this massive city covering 165 acres, and there's probably a lot more that they haven't even found. And I was there a day before yesterday. I was able to, you know, put my hand within an inch of 5,000-6,000-year-old cotton fabrics. I mean, it's just amazing the excavations that they're doing. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Starry Sky, in just a minute, that segue is going to make perfect sense if Beth is calling about what I think she is. Beth in Minneapolis, Minnesota, on the line. Hey, Beth, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I'm so excited for you. What are you there to find? What do you hope to see?
I'm working on a book called Threshold, which is a sequel to my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, which came out in 1992, I think, which was about the end of oil, in which I was predicting that by 2000, 2005, we'd see oil wars and peak oil and all these things. And the question is, will we survive? You know, will civilization survive? How can we survive? You know, what are the transitions that we're going to make? And at the core of this question is the question of the essential nature of people. Khrushchev famously made a joke once. He was talking with Richard Nixon, and he said there's no such thing as, they were talking about UFOs.
Uh-huh.
And I remember this quite clearly. This is in the mid-1960s. And Nixon said, why would there be no UFOs? And Khrushchev said, because if any civilization developed itself to the point where it was capable of that kind of technology, it would destroy itself. Khrushchev so believed that the essential nature of people was evil that he thought that, you know, basically we were doomed to blow ourselves up. And that's, you know, fundamentally the conservative worldview, is that people are evil and therefore they have to have a strong and powerful state or church to control their evil impulses.
Right.
And if that's the case, then we probably are in big trouble. And so I was very curious. This is the oldest city, the oldest virgin city, mother city in the world, an uncontaminated original city.
Right.
The only time we've ever been able to actually see what it looked like for 1,000 years, people making the transition from hunting gathering to living in highly complex social situations. I mean, they built pyramids there at Corral that I saw day before yesterday that are, a couple hundred feet high, and I mean, they're huge. And talking with Dr. Shady, Dr. Ruth Shady, who is the archaeologist who put this thing on the map and figured it all out, she said that in her opinion, the thing that caused them to live in peace for 1,000 years, and then it vanished apparently because of a local climate change. There was a massive drought that lasted at least 2 generations, and the sand and it just came in and covered everything. A massive La Nina kind of event,
mm-hmm.
Which happens every couple thousand years. But in any case, she said the thing that caused them to be able to live in peace was apparently that they had egalitarian relations between the genders. Men and women had equal power. Now, if that's the case, you're not going to have population explosions. You're not going to have the kind of pressures that cause war,
right.
Number one. Number two, they were living in balance with their environment around them. They weren't engaging in unsustainable agriculture practices like the Epic of Gilgamesh tells us, for example, that the Mesopotamians did. Where their story was that the god of gods Enlil punished Gilgamesh by turning the soil to sand, or to salt rather, and that was basically bad irrigation practices.
Right.
And also by creating desert, and that was because they cut down the cedars of Lebanon to create the city of Uruk.
Yeah.
And Gilgamesh did, and in the story he cut off the head of the forest god Humbuba, and so Enlil, the god of gods, punished him for this. But really it's the oldest known story of unsustainable, ecologically unsustainable practices of downwind desertification as a result of upwind deforestation. And the salination of the soil as a result of unsustainable irrigation practices. They didn't do that here in Corral. They weren't doing those things. They had figured out how to live in balance with their environment and in balance with the community that was on the seacoast, where they had a lot of anchovies, but they needed cotton to make fishing nets to catch them. And the folks in Corral wanted the anchovies, and they had a lot of cotton that they were growing, and they were trading with these people. And I saw these things. I mean, I saw a 6,000-year-old fish net yesterday,
wow.
The day before yesterday. And so it frankly gives me great hope. And Dr. Shady, in our last conversation, as I was leaving, we were sitting and talking, and I've got my notes are in my bag, or I'd pull it out and read you verbatim her words, but here's from memory essentially what she said.
Uh-huh.
Because they found all these circular areas and these kind of astrological or astronomical areas.
Uh-huh.
And she said the people of this area spent a lot of time looking at the sky.
Uh-huh.
And they were very connected to the stars. And if we spent more time looking at the stars and realized how small the Earth is, how finite it is, and how small we are in relation to it, we might have more respect for it, and we might understand what they understood about the importance of living in balance with this little blue marble going through the universe.
Tom, that's also beautiful. I just get this thought, though, that maybe, what is that term, we're succeeding downward?
I don't know. I don't know what the term is.
We're
talking about entropy?
We're achieving downward. I mean, we're not, we don't seem to be getting smarter as a race, do we?
I think some of us, I think many of us are. You know, I mean, consider, Beth, that 200 years ago, slavery was the norm in the world. 200 years ago, women had virtually no rights anywhere in the world. 200 years ago, most societies were apartheid. 100 years ago, most societies were apartheid. I think that, you know, our technology has improved, and in some ways it's made us more potentially destructive, and our population explosion is a real problem. We're facing some very real problems. But I think that when George Washington said, "I hope I shall ever see America at the forefront of liberality," you know, in other words, always trying to make society better, always trying to make a better place.
Right,
I think
right.
he was right. I think we've done it. You know, the candidacy, for example, of Barack Obama, or even had it been Hillary Clinton, gives me tremendous hope in that regard.
Well,
and it's one of the things about McCain that scares me.
Yes, absolutely. I think that most of the people, in my opinion, most of the people in the world today want a better life. They don't want to encroach upon their neighbor. They want to live peaceably with their families and friends. But somehow this isn't, we are being controlled by a few major forces.
Yeah, if some very large defense contractors who also happen to own television networks, for example. Beth, thanks a lot for the call.
Oh, thank you,
I've got to wrap it up here. It's at the top of the hour. It's 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here on Air America Radio, broadcasting live coast to coast in the United States and here in Lima, Peru at Union La Radio.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from Lima, Peru. With many thanks to Union La Radio, AM 880, shortwave 6.155 MHz, FM 103.3. Providing us with studio space and partially simulcasting our show. Chalmers Johnson is on the line. He's the author of Nemesis, The Last Days of the American Republic, the final volume in his Blowback trilogy, which includes Blowback and The Sorrows of Empire, one of the most profound, deepest observers of the scene, in my opinion, these days. Chalmers Johnson, welcome to the show.
How do you do? Pleasure to talk with you again.
Thank you. Thank you for being back with us. I'm sitting here in Lima, Peru, and last night, over the last couple of days, I mean, the buzz here, the screaming headlines, the 32-point headlines that I'm not seeing in the American media. I'm only seeing briefly mentioned in the American media and only briefly mentioned on CNN and BBC News that I was able to get my hotel room here, is the meltdown in Bolivia next door.
Yes, absolutely.
And last night, Hugo Chavez was going on at some length on Peruvian television about how this was the American CIA, the American Empire, trying to stir up problems in Bolivia. You know, my thought on that is that, you know, probably we have some hand in this, but, you know, there's enough wealth and power in Bolivia itself that any attempt to try to challenge its power would be, you know, you would expect there to be blowback. But, you know, what's your take on what's going on down here right now?
Oh, I think there is no question that the Americans continue to try to push forward in their pretense that they are something they like to call democratic imperialists. It's a contradiction in terms, an oxymoron. It goes back to ancient Athens, which also thought of itself as a democratic empire and ultimately ended up losing its empire and came pretty close to losing its existence as a result. It is a very, very sorry record of nations that attempt it, but the hubris of democratic empire is a rationalization to people and make them continue to interfere in other people's business. It seems to me that there's no question that whatever you think of Hugo Chavez or Morales or of the leftward trend in Latin American democracies, that the Americans resent this. that they regard it as, well, about the same way that Russia still regards Georgia as a former part of its backyard, a place where it calls the shots.
A sphere of influence.
Pardon me?
Part of their sphere of influence.
Yes, exactly. And that this is a disaster. It's simply a disaster. We have been doing, that is to say, we've been responsible in Latin America in the last 30, 40 years of the 20th century for some of the worst and most outrageous crimes ever committed. It's hard to imagine a worse dictatorship than that directly sponsored by the CIA in Chile of General Augusto Pinochet. But then we spread it throughout the entire southern cone of Latin America with so-called Operation Condor. It would be impossible for the Bolivians not to believe that they're on the receiving end of a very, very old American attempt essentially to enslave these people, to make them subordinate to the Americans, and for the Americans to then claim to themselves that we're doing it for your own good, or to prevent Soviet communism from arriving in Latin America, or any number of the numerous other excuses that have been used over the years. Defense of capitalism, which we have a very highly developed academic economics world to justify, even though its results in Latin America are largely unjustifiable. Mm-hmm. It's so that I think sitting in Peru is a good place to be, since we've this is a place that we've been basically. Or you're in Bolivia, are you?
No, I'm in Peru.
You're in Lima, Peru
right now.
Where we've been more or less excluded. We've tried in various ways to send American troops, we did last year, to Peru to, well, we set a project to dig
wells. It was ostensibly as part of the drug war, but they kind of said thanks but no thanks, in a very limited way, basically.
I mean, in Ayacucho, the old Sendero Luminoso area of Peru, the local political leaders all said, look, we are capable of digging our own wells. We don't need 1,000 armed troops doing that sort of thing. You wonder, who do the Americans think they are? What is Southern Command that's a military command to basically dominate Latin America and push its weight around?
Here's a question.
Our activities in Latin America that make our stance over Russia, East Europe, NATO so hypocritical.
Yeah, and I don't disagree. You've brilliantly exposed this in your blowback trilogy. We're talking with Chalmers Johnson, his most recent book, Nemesis. Here's the question though that I think that probably the average American struggles with, to the extent that they may consider these things at all. One of the consequences of absolute isolationism, arguably, was Dachau and Auschwitz and like that. And there is a point, there has to be a point, at which any civilized people looks at uncivilized things being done and says
Absolutely.
It is appropriate for us to intervene. And in Central and South America in particular, this being the hemisphere that the United States is located in, there are people on the, to use these words in a very sloppy fashion, people on the right who are saying there must be stability, and to have stability you must have strongman governments, and you must have a core of wealthy people who essentially control and maintain a multi-generational cultural and social and political stability. And then you've got people on, again, very sloppily describing it, people on the left who say societies more appropriately should be more like those envisioned actually arguably by the American ideal, whether the founders actually believe their rhetoric or not or acted it out certainly is a whole other discussion, but it's the direction that we've been moving for 200 years toward a more egalitarian society. We now have an African-American running for president of the United States in Bolivia next door to where I am. They have Evo Morales, who is an Indian, an indigenous person. I'm not sure what the word is. That's not a slur down here. If we are to intervene, and it's almost impossible for us not to simply because we trade with these people, On which side do we fall? Or how do we walk the line of being a good neighbor and not being somebody who, not being a country and individuals, for that matter, who create, you know, who provoke the law of unintended consequences?
Our overarching commitment has to be a good neighbor. And that's what we've not been. I mean, that is to say, in your contrast between a sort of right-wing commitment to stability and a left-wing commitment to social reform, that a kind of hardcore authoritarian regime versus an alleged American ideal, there is still a third course. There's the world that is the only nations in the third world in the entire post-war period that beat the odds and became rich. That is all of East Asia, including today the world's largest social system, China, which is deeply involved with Venezuela and other nations in Latin America. And this is a different approach to that taught in the Harvard Economics Department. This is industrial policy. This is putting your nation first, putting your people first, not listening to the International Monetary Fund and other allegedly international organizations that are all located within a few hundred yards of the Department of the Treasury in Washington, D.C. on 8th Street, whose record is abominable, simply abominable on what they've done in Latin America. The entire continent was much richer and much happier well before the Americans got involved. That was also helped generate the social gospel. This is the sort of thing that we have to get back to.
I absolutely agree. We're talking with Chalmers Johnson, his newest book, Nemesis, the Last Days of the American Republic. Sir, can you stick around over the break? I'd like to ask you about the disintegrating American Republic.
Of course.
Okay, great. It's 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here, broadcasting live from Lima, Peru.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Cause when I was a child, with my heart in my hand, I pledged my allegiance to the flag of this land, where Kennedy was killed in a Texas cow town, and we learned how to hide it from the bomb underground. So when the things that you tell me don't match what you do, I'd be a fool not to have a huge problem with you. And I'll still stand and fight for this land of the free. First we'll take back the ground that we lost in D.C. So stand and let your voice be heard. Stand and let your voice be heard. Stand up, speak out. This is still our country, so stand and let your voice ring free.
Standing and speaking out. This is 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, 52 weeks a year for 6 years now. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio, the Tom Hartman Program. 22 minutes past the hour, talking with Chalmers Johnson, the author of the Blowback Trilogy. The first, The Sorrows of Empire, the first was Blowback in 2000, then The Sorrows of Empire in 2004. And his most recent addition to that, Nemesis, The Last Days of the American Republic. Chalmers Johnson, welcome back.
Good morning.
It's an almost surreal experience being here, just the next country over, Bolivia, experiencing this meltdown right next door to me. I mean, literally right next door to me. And it is in many regards, what you're talking about, even if we were to say that there was no American involvement, it's nonetheless.
But there's a lot of people who believe there are Americans involved.
Particularly a lot of them down here.
Right.
To what extent we started out our conversation in the last segment. You mentioned the idea of democratic empire, small
right.
democratic empire, and this fantasy that the Greeks had, that that we have had, I would say, probably since George Washington. Washington seemed to argue against this in his farewell address, but
right.
But then along came the Monroe Doctrine. Of course, that was four presidents later. But you know, I mean, even Sam Adams was trying to gin up a war against, or John Adams rather, was trying to gin up a war against France.
No question.
With the XYZ affair. To what extent is this idea of a small d democratic empire, to what extent has it helped the United States become a strong and powerful nation? To what extent has it harmed us? To what extent might it have been useful, or was it never useful? To what extent is it now an anachronism or in need of reform?
I think it's never useful. It's a contradiction in terms. It is it's a trap in which it's like a wife beater claiming he's doing this for your own good. There's no redeeming virtue ever in imperialism. Imperialism is a pardon me, is an undiluted form of tyranny. It never rules by consent. It always means the domination of one nation over others, usually for exploitative purposes. Democratic imperialism is an excuse. It's a claim that we're doing this for your own good, that you may not realize it, but ultimately this will benefit you. It was an old British saw in British imperialism for two centuries. But just try asking an Indian about what a century of British imperialism was like, in which the country never grew half of 1%. And suffered endless famines thanks to imported ideology. I just say that the truth of the matter is a successful, honest country would reorient its foreign policy to be defensive, ameliorative, to attempt to maintain the ideals that we have set up, the sorts of institutions that we tried to develop after World War II in the United Nations, the Marshall Plan, things of this sort. Where we recognized our obligations instead of the possessive individualism that we today trumpet and gets us into hopeless contradictions.
And yet our presidential candidates, I mean, it's impossible to run for political office right now without saying, I will defend America's interest anywhere, anyone, you know,
well,
et cetera. I mean,
this is why it's hard to believe that the political system is going to save us. One, if we have a new defining election, something like 1932, then it's conceivable. And on a morning in which we've just put Lehman Brothers out to starve to death and seen the Bank of America try, if they can digest it, to take over Merrill Lynch, with that is the very foundations of our economic system tottering, we should be very, very cautious about the kind of, the waste of our resources on worthless military gadgets that we expend
half
around the world. One of the things we try to do in Peru or other Latin American nations is to sell them military equipment they surely do not need, or that it would be at least up to them to say we need this equipment rather than our sending an army of salesmen from the Pentagon down to try and force it down their throats. This is the sort of thing that they've come to resent with good reason.
And rightfully so. Chalmers Johnson, his latest book, your latest book, Nemesis, and highly recommended, although also you want to pick up Sorrows of Empire and Blowback and get the whole story. Sir, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you very much for the nice plugs for the book.
You're welcome. Good talking with you. Excellent, excellent writing. 27 minutes past the hour. Back with your calls right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
About you, I punch the clock.
clock trying to make it to the top. How about you? I ain't got no blue blood trust fund I can dip into. Yeah, I wish Uncle Sam would give a damn about the man whose collar's blue. But if he don't, hell, I'll make it on my own. How about you?
34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here in Lima, Peru. I'll tell you, it was downright odd. Surreal is almost the right word. The region, 150 miles, 200 kilometers north of Lima, where we were traveling through some long stretches of very, very empty road, where just a few years ago the Shining Path was regularly blowing up transmission power lines, and in fact Dr. Shady, the anthropologist that I visited, had been her driver had been shot. She had been shot, and so here I am in this car that we set up. There's a company here. Adventure Safe Tours, I think it's, or Travel or something like that it's called. And, you know, they specialize in basically getting people to places without getting dead. And so I'm in the front seat of the car, is the driver and a bodyguard. They're both former Navy SEALs, and they're both carrying, you know, 9mm pistols. And my translator, Renan, very, very nice guy, sitting in the back with me, and he's got a gun in his pocket. And, you know, he's telling me how, well, the way that they rob people is they'll roll the boulders out into the road, and then when you stop the car, they jump out and stick a gun to your head. In fact, just a couple weeks ago, just in the street a block from my hotel, a bus, the bus that goes around and picks up all the people from all the hotels and takes them to the airport, this bus with 40 some odd people on it, was stopped. You know, somebody ran in front of it with a car and swung the car around to the side, so the bus had to stop. Three guys with AK-47s jump out, get into the bus, and robbed everybody. I mean, broad daylight right in front of the hotels. So anyhow, I'm traveling out here in the middle of nowhere. I didn't want to publicize where I was going to be or what I was going to do before I went, because there are people, you know, out there with guns and poor intent. On the way to see a city that existed for 1,000 years in peace. So they have excavated a corral. They have excavated musical instruments, artwork, textiles, fabric. Now, this is a pre-ceramic civilization. I mean, they had no metal. They didn't even have pottery. But they had figurines. They had art. They made music. They had very sophisticated musical instruments. Apparently, and no implements of warfare at all. And I just thought the paradox was excruciating. It was extraordinary. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Jerry in Atlantic City, New Jersey, excuse me. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say how wonderful it's been the last 6 months. I've been listening to your tremendous intellect and logic and sense that you make. And I appreciate it. It's kept me out of the local insane asylum, I think.
Me too.
The right-wing mental midgets down here in talk radio. My wife of 18 years is from Lima, Peru. And a year or so after we were married, they went down to meet our family. And we were supposed to stay about 2 weeks, and I stayed 2 days. I was so nervous and afraid. You know, I'm 6'2", 230, and stood out like a target. And
when was this surgery?
About 92, 91. The Sumandera Luminoso, the Shining Path you were talking about, were all over the place. And you went into a restaurant, and everybody had Uzis and to protect the people. And I got out of there fast. All I could think of is Butch Cassidy as Sundance Kid when they went to Bolivia and never returned.
I was here the first and only other time I was here was in either 79 or 80, and I was staying in a hotel about three blocks from the Presidential Palace, and the Shining Path set off a bomb outside the Presidential Palace that knocked me out of bed. I remember. I've seen those. It's much better now. Hey, come and visit. It's a beautiful country.
That's what Rhode Island, and the people are so wonderful. My wife was a lawyer, and I met her when she was cleaning rooms at one of the casinos here, and her friend was a doctor who was in the, you know, they come up, people from Peru are just wonderful people, and it's amazing
yes.
how, well, what poverty does to you, actually, is what the case
well,
is.
Well, I think that's the bottom line, is what Chalmers Johnson and I were talking about, and Mark Weisbrot, for that matter, the echoes of imperialism, whether it's the Spanish, the conquistador imperialism, or the American imperialism, or, you know, whatever, those echoes, and the echoes of hierarchy and patriarchy, are very alive and well all across the world, but also here.
Yeah, maybe you could answer one more question for me. I was amazed when I first met her that I mentioned the Incas, and really I was praising, you know, that great civilization, and she got very upset. She said, I am not an Inca. I am not an Apache, she said. They weren't proud of the Incas there because they were people from the mountain that were a different class of people than people from the cities. And I was wondering why that is. I'll have to get that book. That fellow who called you said he wrote a book about the Incas. But do you know why that is, that they're not proud of that because they look down on people from the mountain?
Well, in part, you know, the indigenous people of South America have been oppressed since the Spaniards basically took over in the 1600s. There have been, as our first guest, Mark Westbrook, pointed out, up until very recently in Bolivia, the country next door, where they're having all the problems today.
Yeah,
as we
you
speak.
Mentioned that. I never knew that history, but
they had legal apartheid.
Yeah.
And that was not unique, by the way. Over the last 200 years, that was more the norm than the exception.
A lot of countries and so forth. You're just so wonderful, Tom, and keep up the great work.
Thanks a lot, Jerry, and thanks a lot for the call. It's great to hear from you, and say hi to your Peruvian wife for me. Peruvian people are absolutely wonderful. In fact, I'll have to put the name Patricia Viejas, her travel agency coordinated all this trip for me, and I'll put her name and contact information on our website over the next day or two if anybody is thinking about coming down. It's actually a very, very beautiful place. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Steve in Los Angeles. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind today?
Hey, everybody. I take issue with you, Tom, for bringing up the law of unintended consequences. I do believe that that's by bringing it up and not fully discussing all the implications of it, I think it's providing a disservice to your listeners.
Okay.
When you think about unintended consequences, sir, you have to realize that an assumption is being made as to whose intentions are causing these consequences. And to think that it's the intentions of, let's say, democracies, people, leading up to these consequences is wrong.
No, you're absolutely right. I thought that was fairly explicit in what we were saying, or implicit anyway in what we were saying. That, for example, when we deposed the Shah, it wasn't for the broad good of the American people or the Iranians, for that matter. It was for a small coterie of oil companies and the oil barons associated with it.
Exactly.
And the same thing down here in South America. In fact, Patricia was telling me about and a couple of other people actually here have been telling me about some of the American mining companies and some of the problems that they're having that the Peruvians are having with them.
Yeah.
Your point is well made.
I know your intentions are very good, and everybody's, mine included. I want to intend well, but by excluding the complete discussion of this, we lapse back into the mindset that allows whether you call them corporatists or globalized controllers,
to do their
bidding and to hijack our democracy, let alone the whole globalization progress.
Yeah.
Process.
No, spot on, Steve, and well said. And it's also they're also hijacking our banking system, and they want to hijack our savings, or they want to hijack our Social Security. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. So there is no end to it. Peter in Blaine, Washington. Thanks for the call, Steve. Peter in Blaine, Washington. Hey, Peter.
Yeah. Hey, Tom. I just wanted to say, in 1970, I was senior in high school living in Buenos Aires, Argentina, and I had the privilege of going to Santiago de Chile on a little trip, and this was just before
Allende was elected.
Yeah.
And I have to say I've never seen so much enthusiasm, you know, around an election as there was then. You know, I mean,
oh, the people were very excited about Allende. I was going to say I was in Buenos Aires. I think about 7 years ago, I wrote an article about it for Common Dreams because the people. This was right after Bush was elected and right after 9/11, and the people were predicting that he would use it to start wars.
Yeah.
And I remember I was staying with a family, just middle class family, some friends of friends, and I'm sitting in the kitchen table in the kitchen, and this woman's friend is over, and they're both in their 50s, I'd say. And her friend, you know, very nicely dressed, middle-class woman, is very casually telling us how they burned her nipples off when they tortured her during the oppressive era, as it were.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the hell that people have gone through in this part of the world is absolutely startling. Peter, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back with more of your calls, 866-303-2270, our telephone number, 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. I'm there right now. And, of course, AirAmerica.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Enough of us get involved, if enough of us become politicians, maybe we can actually make some changes and some positive changes in this country, in this world. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from Lima, Peru, with many thanks to Union La Radio, AM 880, and shortwave 6.155 FM 103.3, and for the interesting simulcast of part of our program and providing us with studios. And be interested to get the feedback on that, and for all their help, so much help. 866-303-2270, our phone number. John in Alameda, California. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Yes, I was curious that this hurricane that hit Texas, Pastor Hagee didn't say why it hit Texas. Is that because George Bush is president? And also, I noticed the people in Texas weren't refugees. I find that very strange.
Whereas the word refugee was applied to the people in Louisiana.
Correct. I'm originally from New Orleans, and I'm also a longtime Union member.
Yeah.
I love your show. But don't you find that rather strange?
And did you notice also that this time when the hurricane before Ike, I'm forgetting the names and the sequences right at the moment, but the one that did hit Louisiana, but not very hard, that the responders were there in advance and they had a million tons of water and they had this and that and the other thing. It's really quite amazing how I think, frankly, that what happened with Katrina happened because the governor was Catherine Blanco was a Democrat.
Correct.
I really believe that the Bush administration, you look at the ratio of prosecutions of politicians over the last 6 years has been 7-1 Democrats to Republicans. If you're a Democrat, you're 7 times more likely to get prosecuted if you're in office than if you're a Republican. And frankly, I think that if you're the governor of a state and you're a Democrat and that state has a disaster, you can just kiss your butt goodbye. And if you're the governor of a state and you're a Republican, then the federal government is going to be, they have politicized everything.
Oh, I know they have. I also find it curious that Blackwater didn't go to Texas and take everybody's guns away like they did in New Orleans.
Yeah, exactly. Well, they had Rick Perry's down there in Texas. I think he's still the governor, right, in Texas.
Yeah.
And so they've got a good Republican governor, and therefore they're gonna do everything they can. John, thanks a lot for the call and for pointing it out. David in Fort Lauderdale. Hey, David.
Hey, how you doing? I wanted to chime in. Coincidentally, like the other gentleman, I've been married to a Peruvian for 18 years. And she was here going to school when we met. And I go just about every year, at least once or twice a year. I go down there surfing, among other things that you can enjoy down in Peru. And when I started going, there was still the shining path. I remember, you know, them picking glass out of the downtown buildings because a bomb went off and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But to compare it to where it is now, it's amazing. I mean, their economy, everything is booming, and there's just no comparison. People are doing really well. Comparing it to what we're dealing with in the U.S., they're even more stable. I'd rather live there than here at this point right now.
Yeah, there are places here that are a whole lot safer than Manhattan. You know, my point where we were going out in the hinterlands, you know, in the middle of nowhere. In fact, where Corral is located, up until the last two or three years, there were no roads, you know, much less electricity or water or anything else. And so we had to go out armed, but you're right. Peru has tremendous stability, and I think Peru and Brazil in particular are countries that have that are really, you know, moving in some very, very right directions.
Yeah, and I say that reluctantly because on one hand it's nice, you know, they got their Machu Picchu is one of the new seven wonders. I think the tourism, mm-hmm. and now that I go down there more and more, it's just you could see the increase in tourism, the investment,
yeah.
And it's something that on one hand I'd like to get the word out. On the other hand, I don't want to see overcrowding either, like you see in some countries like Costa Rica and other places where Americans tend to just swarm now. And Peru, because of the cost of the dollar, you can go down there and live very nicely. So it's, I think it's got a lot of future to it. I don't know if you made it down to the water. They have that water fountain display. It's probably as nice as anything you'd see in anywhere else in the world. It's kind of like a Bellagio kind of water fountain display.
If you
might want to check it out. But anyway, I'm glad to hear you're down there and enjoy it.
Thank you. Thank you very much, David. And thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening there on Winds in Miami. Consuelo in San Jose, California. Hey, Consuelo.
Hey. No, actually, I'm in Santa Fe.
Oh, okay. Oh, I'm sorry.
New Mexico.
Santa
Fe,
New Mexico. All the better. Hey.
I met you once at a prophets conference in California.
Years ago.
Yeah, years ago. I'm a singer. I'm an American citizen, but my parents are South American. My mother's from Chile. My father was from Cuba. I grew up in Lima, Peru, actually, from age 11 to 18.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I had to call today, I've never called you, I listen to you all the time, is that you're touching on subjects that are so dear to me, close to me. My Chilean grandfather, Carlos Davila, led the first socialist revolution in the Western Hemisphere in 1932 in Chile, which was actually successful. Initially, it was actually backed by a portion of the Navy. And he wanted to bring a real balance between capitalism and socialism.
Mm-hmm.
And he lasted in power for 3 months, after which he was forced out and into exile. There was a plot to assassinate him as U.S. ships sailed towards Chile. To head off this potential shift in political systems down there. And I, of course, agree with Chalmers Johnson. I think Americans need to face up to the fact. I mean, we may think that the last 20 years since Reagan came in is when we've started going downhill, but the fact is that the American policy, and I'm an American citizen, and I also take responsibility for this, but I also see the other side of the picture very clearly.
This is why it's so encouraging that Barack Obama is saying, you know, we need to get out of Iraq. It was a stupid policy in the first place. I mean, it's the beginning, I think, of Americans realizing the limits of our power. Consuelo, thank you for the call. I'm sorry we're out of time. The show's over. But Carl Wilson will be filling in for me tomorrow as I'm traveling back up to San Francisco. And we'll be doing our show live from Green 960, our affiliate in San Francisco, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. And Friday night, you can check it out at Green 960's website. We've got a gig going. I don't have the details right in front of me, but it's over at green960.com. You can check it out. Look forward to our San Francisco listeners to seeing you there Friday night. Thanks so much for being with us, and don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow, or see you after tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.